This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 167, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 160 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Maxime Furyk about his book, The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot. Maxime is a former psychologist and rock journalist. His eclectic background includes aspects of psychology, addictions, and popular music. He has written numerous rock biographies and paranormal books, such as Coal Region Hoodoo, Paranormal Tales from Inside the Pit, and Flying Saucer Esoteric, The Altered States of Ufology. His book, Shepton, The Myth, Miracle, and Music, was featured on Australia's Mysterious Universe. He is a respected contributor to Fate magazine, Paranormal Underground, and Star Beacon. Hi, Maxime. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
Absolutely, Simon. I really appreciated the first go-round we had, and I'm looking forward to discussing some aspects of The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot, which is my latest book. So, thank you for this opportunity.
First of all, could you tell us, how did you get into Bigfoot? What interested you?
Well, in 2023, I had two books that I published. One was Coal Region Hoodoo, Paranormal Tales from Inside the Pit. And in that book, I had two chapters on Bigfoot. One chapter was The Bigfoot Enigma. The other was The Bigfoot Hypothesis. And I was just trying to figure out what Sasquatch could possibly be. What are they saying? What are the theories? So I just put those two chapters together. And it seemed like the universe responded to me, because all of a sudden I got invited to a number of Bigfoot expos and podcasts. So it seemed to, and again, I can't explain it, but it just seemed, those two chapters just seemed to resonate and get me some attention. So I decided that I would go and write a book just concentrating on Bigfoot. And I called it The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot. And it was just something, I was just filled with a whole lot of interest and curiosity. I mean, I'm as fascinated about this thing, the sociocultural / scientific entity that, you know, there's a lot of theories about, but no bodies, no DNA, you know, no bones, none of that. So again, I'm like a lot of other people, and I think a lot of us have that Indiana Jones in us, where we're just searching for the Holy Grail, and you know, we're excited about being on that adventure, you know, looking for the unknown.
So how are Bigfoot and UFOs connected?
With the hardcore ufologists, they're looking for nuts and bolts. They want to see that craft, you know. And with the hardcore Bigfoot people, they want the body. So, you know, you have those two camps there. But with both Bigfoot and UFOs, you have witnesses, you have photographs. You know, certainly with Bigfoot, you have the sounds and the smells. And typically, not always, but typically with Bigfoot, you have these smells that are either like a wet dog or fecal matter, is just something really nasty. But then again, it could be perfumey, or there may be no smell at all. And so some of these folks that I talk to, and I've been on a number of podcast interviews in the British Columbia, which is the epicenter for Sasquatch. But those folks believe that Bigfoot communicates through these smells, and that they could either use it to warn people away, or to say hello with, you know, if it's a nice perfumey smell, or to just have none at all. So they talk about that smell. They talk about the sounds, et cetera. So there's a number of things that that Bigfoot people have seen that tends to have some kind of proof that there's something there. And this goes along with a J. Allen Hynek's theory of high strangeness, that, you know, with UFOs, you may see a UFO, and that's one thing. That's one element of high strangeness. But if it hovers over your car, and if it knocks out the commission of the car and you can't start the car, and if maybe there's lost time, then here's one, two, three aspects, three elements of high strangeness that maybe one in itself is just circumstance or circumstantial, but when you have two or three or four, then there's some validity there. There's something happening there of a paranormal essence. So with both Bigfoot and flying saucers, we have these high levels of strangeness. With Bigfoot in 1967, we had the Patterson-Gimlin film, and that is recognized by a lot of Bigfoot people as the Holy Grail. It's a piece of evidence. It's only 58 seconds long, but that video showing a female Bigfoot, you know, they called it Patty, is the proof that a lot of Bigfoot people point to as being, you know, undeniable proof that this Bigfoot exists. And they say this because it's been reviewed by paleontologists like Jeff Meldrum and Lauren Coleman, individuals like that who have a good pedigree. They have a great resume and, you know, and they're knowledgeable about things like this. So the 1967 Patterson-Gimlin film is just of such value to the Bigfoot community, just as the 2004 United States Navy Tic Tac video is to the people in the UFO realm. And this was back in 2004 when the United States Navy pilots were able to film this video. They called it the Tic Tac video. It looked like a little Tic Tac piece of candy, and they shot it, and it had tremendous G force that we believe human beings could not withstand. But this video showed this UAP, what the Pentagon at the time called unidentified aerial phenomenon. It hovered, it zigzagged, and then it went under the water. So the Pentagon once again changed the nomenclature from UAP, from unidentified aerial phenomenon, to unidentified anomalous phenomenon. So the terms keep on changing, but in the case of Bigfoot and UFOs, those films seem to be the Holy Grail. They seem to be the genuine proof that it's something, you know, that it is indeed anomalous. You know, it's part of that 3% of the things that we see that are anomalous that we can't really explain. So what is it? Well, it seemed to be something, the 2004 video was something that was being controlled. And again, you know, the possibilities are it's ours, it's theirs, or it's either extraterrestrial or interdimensional. And take your pick. But again, 3% of the things that we're saying are can't be explained, and they are indeed anomalous.
So something in your book, you say that Stan Gordon pointed out the biggest UFO outbreak ever documented in 1973 occurred simultaneously with a massive outbreak of Bigfoot reports.
Yeah, when I, first of all, I spent time in Pennsylvania and Florida. So we're what they call snowbirds. So right now I'm down in Florida where it's in the 80s. In Pennsylvania, in Western Pennsylvania, there is an area called Chestnut Ridge. And Chestnut Ridge has an abundance of not only Bigfoot sightings, but Bigfoot sightings in conjunction with orbs and flying saucers. Now, I know it sounds bizarre, but the fact that these two entities are connected shows that there has to be some sort of a paranormal entity, a paranormal element with Bigfoot. Stan Gordon is the guy that is sort of the collector. He's the keeper of the key. And whenever Pennsylvania state troopers get a report about Bigfoot, Dogman, Thunderbirds, or flying saucers, you know, UAPs, they tell these people to call Stan Gordon. So Stan will go and document these. And Stan has all kinds of books that he's written documenting, you know, the fact that, say, Mr. and Mrs. Jones saw an orb land next to the barn, and then there were two Bigfoot creatures that emerge. So countless documented cases of these eyewitnesses that saw Bigfoot creatures and a flying saucer. So there seems to be a predominance of this in Western Pennsylvania in a 4 or 5 county area known as Chestnut Ridge. And when I first heard about this, I thought, this is bizarre. This is totally fantastic and ludicrous, and I don't believe it. But when I started to read some of Stan Gordon's narrative, I was convinced that there's something here. And again, by what is that something? Well, again, J. Allen Hynek's Levels of High Strangeness, numerous, countless witnesses seeing similar things. So whatever that means, whatever that is, however we could explain it, there seems to be something going on here that has all of those elements of Bigfoot and craft, things that we just cannot, that people are seeing, but we can't explain.
And there seems to be a lot more high strangeness with Bigfoot. Oh, I just wanted to ask, is Bigfoot and Sasquatch, and I believe there's the Yowie, and are they all pretty much the same thing all over the world?
Well, maybe yes. We could nitpick and say, that they have other differences, but, it started in the Himalayas with some British explorers that saw these prints, and they were bigger than any bear or human, and they called that the abominable snowman. So we called it the abominable snowman, and then Yeti. In Russia, they had the Almas. In Australia, the Yowie. And then we had our own California abominable snowman. In 1958, the Humboldt Times ran an article about California's abominable snowman, and they called it Bigfoot. So in 1958, this was the first time that the world heard the word Bigfoot, and it went into the lexicon. So the Humboldt Times, this Northern California newspaper, printed this article, and all of a sudden there were thousands of people that responded saying that, yes, I've seen similar things, or yes, I believe. I mean, this article was validated. It showed that there was an interest in this thing. And then the wire services picked it up. So in 1958, this California abominable snowman became news around the world. So a little bit later, people in British Columbia started to say, wait a second, this is not new. This didn't start in 1958. We've seen a thing called Sasquatch for thousands of years, and it's here in British Columbia. So this California Bigfoot is just another derivative, a variation of our Sasquatch, which has been written about and spoken about in the oral tradition of the coastal peoples there in British Columbia. So this Sasquatch creature is supposed to be a spiritual creature. It's supposed to be good luck to have seen a Sasquatch. A Sasquatch is believed to be a protector of the environment, and just all kinds of things that that we didn't get the first time around when we saw this Bigfoot thing. So it's fascinating, and you ask a good question about the connection with Yowie and Almas and all the other ones, but what started in the Himalayas started to go around the world, and we found out that a lot of other countries, have had similar sightings of these ape-like creatures. And I think that maybe in Russia, in this former Soviet Union, they took this more seriously. They had a type of a zoology called this is great. They had a type of zoology where they actually thought that there was a hominology. Thank you. The hominology, a missing link, a relic that maybe brought us closer to this Bigfoot creature, something that might have been connected to Neanderthal man or Gigantopithecus, but something that is out there that that is existing that we have not been able to go and find yet. But it seemed that the Russians were more interested in finding this creature. Back in the 60s, I believe it was, they had a $2 million expedition to go and find this. And they put a lot of research into it. And, you know, and a lot of their researchers, I mean, they had a lot of notoriety for their beliefs, which was totally different than what you might find in the UK or in the United States, where a lot of these researchers or scientists were sort of laughed at. You know, they were sort of looked down upon for dabbling in what was called a pseudoscience, you know, the pseudoscience of cryptozoology, which, you know, we feel is a little adjunct from zoology. But again, the battle rages with the believers and non-believers. And, this continues to this day.
Did you hear about the Oxford University doing some studies? Some people brought some hair samples back from the Himalayas and they said they saw this big white creature. And Oxford University did the DNA testing on the hair and they said it was a bear that they thought had gone extinct 20,000 years ago.
Yeah, all of the hair and alleged DNA that we're coming up with, we seem to be able to explain away as either a black bear or a sun bear, or, you know, some of these, unique species that might be in Asia or in North America. So we have never come up with a body or with DNA or with hair samples. And it's just so elusive, but I'm not familiar with the latest study, but I try to stay on top of this just to find out what's new and improved. I mean, have we found anything? Because all of us are looking. We're looking for that next clue. And there's numerous people that believe that, and I don't believe this totally, but there's a lot of people that believe that these Bigfoot sightings can be attributed to black bears. So, you know, standing on 2 feet like a hominid. So I don't quite believe that. I think that there's room for speculation and conjecture. And I think there's enough proof out there that, you know, to say that, you know, to get my attention and to say that there's something there, something of substance.
So the high strangeness with Bigfoot gets even stranger when you hear that there may be tracks that just stop somewhere. It's like the Bigfoot has just disappeared.
Yeah, and again, and when you hear stories like that, it denotes a paranormal aspect, that it's not just, you know, flesh and blood, but there's something else. And Rosemary Ellen Guiley, who was, she was with Fate magazine and she was renowned. She has passed, but Rosemary talked about bilocation and rapid transport. And she said that you would see a Bigfoot creature in front of you, and then it would be behind you. And she talked about the bilocation or this rapid transport that she called it. But she said that Bigfoot creatures can transform from the material and tangible to the intangible. And this was something that coastal tribes in British Columbia talked about. They believe that Sasquatch could assume different shapes and could hide with that. So, it's interesting. My personal belief is that both Bigfoot and UFOs may have the ability to shapeshift through interdimensional channels. And that's one reason why we see them. You see them and then you don't. And I'm not talking about anything that's new. It's, this was conjectured back in the 1930s with Albert Einstein and other researchers. And Einstein talked about the wormhole theory. And he said that there may be holes in the space-time continuum that would allow entities to travel, to traverse light years of mileage, but to go from point A to point B in microseconds. And he believed that there was an interdimensional pathways. Again, this is all theoretical, but if in fact this can be proven, then that would be the pathway. That would be the doorway for things like Bigfoot and, you know, other paranormal entities, you know, UAPs, to be able to travel from point A to point B. And the other thing, interdimensional, the hypothesis, to me, seems to be a lot more plausible and rational than intergalactic travel. I mean, I just think about it. I don't care how advanced, you know, the space brothers are, the alien brothers are, but it takes a lot of energy to go from, you know, trillions of light years away from their planet to ours. It just makes more sense to talk about an interdimensional pathway, which takes less time and effort. And who knows the toll that it would place on these aliens if they had to travel those distances. You know, when Einstein talked about his theory of relativity, you know, the faster you go, the slower time travels. And there's all kinds of sci-fi stories about these spaceships, these astronauts going to another planet and coming back. And when they came back, time slowed for them, but they go back and here their wife is maybe 40 years older than when they left. So, you know, that's part of Einstein's theory of relativity, that, you know, that the time slows. So again, you know, there's a lot of things to take a look at. And I think as researchers, we need to take a look at the existing knowledge in physics and astronomy and everything else, and make sense of that before we go off on a tangent and come up with new improved hypotheses, trying to explain those before we could explain things like Einstein's theory of relativity or wormhole theory or some of these other things. So again, Tesla was on the right track when he said, if you want to know the secrets of the universe, take a look at frequency and vibration and energy. And the secrets are there. And I think we need to, us researchers and us scientists need to dedicate more time looking to those areas to try to find the answers. So I would hope that, you know, that there would be answers, some answers coming about.
So in the book, you mention the CIA Bigfoot UFO connection. What's the CIA doing?
I believe that was the one of the researchers sent DNA to the CIA for analysis, and after and they did this not so much that they believed in this, but they did it as a friend, you know, as a favor, and they found out that this was again DNA from a black bear. So again, there was nothing alien or unnatural from these DNA fibers that were found. And, you know, and throughout history, people have gone to the Himalayas and found relics of the abominable snowman of Yeti, and they've been able to go and take some of these samples to the Western world and get them analyzed. And again, we have not come up with anything substantial. In the world of Bigfoot, I think in the world of ufology, it's a lot more exciting because, you know, we have all kinds of people like David Grush and Bob Lazar and those folks who are coming forward and saying that the government knows where these bodies are and they know where the crashed vehicles are. And at least in the United States, they're paying lip service to this. The government is saying, or the Pentagon is saying, that they want to be more transparent. And this did start in July of 2023, where there were congressional hearings, and they interviewed David Grush, who was a former military intelligence. And Grush claimed that he had interviewed 40 individuals who had top secret clearances, who told them their story. And he said that they were retro-engineering these crafts that were captured. Some of these folks were injured during this process, but claims that he knows where the vehicles are and the bodies are. Now, being down here in Florida, I wrote a letter to Senator Marco Rubio. Now, Marco is currently the Secretary of State, so he's no longer in the UFO realm and dabbling in that. But Marco at the time was on one of the committees, the government committees, trying to get some of the answers. I wrote him a letter and I said this. I said, Senator Rubio, I would like to encourage in your committee to encourage David Grish to show his cards. You know, he says he knows people that know where the bodies are and knows where the vehicles are. Make him show his cards. You know, don't just tease us with this, but give us some information. So Marco Rubio wrote back to me, and some of it was doublespeak, but I was planning to do another letter to him just to keep the correspondence going. And then at that point, he was nominated as the Secretary of State. So I lost my contact, but again, David Grush believed that he knows where these things are. And then the other one was the government did it again last year, and they had Luis Elizondo there. Again, everybody that testified claimed that they knew that the government knew where things were. So this is as close to the truth as we have. We have people saying that they know the government knows, and that's as close as we're getting to this thing. Nobody's showing their cards. Nobody is anteing up. It's just almost like a tease, a dance, even though the government, the Pentagon, is saying that they want to be transparent. Well, they're not being transparent. You know, it's like George Orwell. It's like 1984. They're talking out of both sides of their mouth, and they're not giving us citizens the information that we need.
I wanted to ask you about a case that happened in 1966 with six Jamestown, New York visitors, and they saw a UFO near their car.
Yes. Okay. And that was in Project Blue Book. And it was a case that took place on a Presque Isle in Erie, Pennsylvania. So that's very close to New York. And a number of people came there on vacation. And let me see, they saw orbs. They saw what looked like a disc. And then they saw Bigfoot creatures. The car broke down. There were maybe six of them there. And the guys walked to the one guard station, brought back some law enforcement, and what they saw were indentations in the ground. It looked like it was from a vehicle. I think they were triangular in shape. And then they also saw on the car, the roof of the car, they saw indentations from where this cryptid creature had jumped up and landed. So there were, with J. Allen Hynek, he talked about, you know, the close encounters of the first, second, and third kind. And with the this one, it was a CE2 because they actually saw evidence of a vehicle. And although I don't believe that they saw any alien creatures, they did see cryptids. So, but again, J. Allen Hynek has to be appreciated for having given our realm nomenclature and vocabulary, because before that there were none. And with closer encounters of the first kind, he talked about actually seeing vehicles, seeing evidence, seeing the creatures, the aliens. And then even Stephen Greer went as far as and then CE4 being abducted. And then Stephen Greer talking about CE5, which is some sort of I believe, looking for aliens and connecting or communicating with aliens. But Stephen Greer took it a step further. But again, it was J. Allen Hynek, formerly a skeptic, who didn't believe in any of this UFO stuff. And he was an advisor for the government's Project Blue Book, Grunge, and Sign. And he, whenever somebody would go and, say that they saw something, he would discount it. Later on, J. Allen Hynek went from being a skeptic to being a true believer. And he said that the scientific community was being disrespectful to witnesses who were seeing things. He said, rather than asking these witnesses what they had seen, you know, where it was in relation to cars and other things, with instead of trying to use the scientific method to get information, they were immediately discounting these eyewitness reports as being hallucinations or maybe neurotic, psychotic individuals or just a lot of nonsense like that. J. Allen Hynek apologized for that. He stopped doing that, and he started to get a lot more serious whenever he interviewed people who had seen, you know, alleged UFOs and saucers. So again, J. Allen Hynek is one of the rock stars in our realm, and has given us the vocabularies that we really need and helped us, brought us a little bit closer to understanding some of these things.
So why is it, do you think, that no one's ever found a Bigfoot body? If there were lots of them out there, surely by now we would have come across one. Is there something paranormal going on there?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, that's a good question. I've been asked that so many times. But where I live here in Florida, a couple of weeks ago, there was a they have wild pigs here, and they're big black things. And I noticed that there was a dead black pig on the side of the road. You know, it was hit by a car, and there it was. So over a two-week period, vultures came and devoured it, the elements, the rain, the sun, and everything. In a two-week period, that pig was reduced to just a skin, a dried-out skin. So if, in fact, this pig was in the forest, was in the woods, there's a lot more predators, you know, I mean, away from highways and that, a lot more predators and things that would go after it and get rid of it. So it's not unusual for carcasses of bear and whatever, you know, animals in the woods to be totally obliterated by scavengers and by the process of nature. So we've never come across any Bigfoot carcasses, either because of nature destroying that, or because of maybe some people say that Bigfoot is a cannibal, or that Bigfoot buries their people, like Neanderthal did. We know that Neanderthal. And speaking of Homo sapiens and their Neanderthal, maybe possibly being a connection to Bigfoot. We have plenty of evidence of Neanderthal because they like to hang out in sandstone caves. And so when they died, and they buried their dead, but when they died, there was all kinds of preserved relics, fire pits, you know, burial grounds, all this stuff, you know, pottery, et cetera, that they had. So we have good information on Neanderthal. We don't have much information on Bigfoot. We're not quite sure, but, who knows? I mean, I get this question again, why haven't we ever been able to find a body? And that's exactly what we're looking for. You know, we'd like to find, not only would we like to find a Bigfoot body, we'd like to find a crashed, a UAP, you know, someplace. So, you know, and, you know, we've had plenty of people say that the government has them and knows where they are. But again, there's no dice and not coming up with anything. And even Bob Lazar was the latest one that claimed that he was working on these craft. And there was three of them that he spoke of. And he said that the sport model was the one that he was working on. And there were reports that at a Las Vegas conference, Bob Lazar was going to go and present this UAP to the audience. This was going to be proof, irrefutable proof that these things do exist. So I haven't heard anything from that, but I was looking forward to that information, but haven't heard of that yet.
So I was wondering about the bodies not being found, because there's these ideas of portals, and that maybe Bigfoot can just disappear, because I'm sure there's been reports about that they teleport, they glide instead of walking.
Yeah, all that. Yeah. And again, it tends to make us think that there's that Bigfoot has some sort of paranormal abilities, that instead of walking, they glide, that their eyes don't reflect light, but they emit light, that Bigfoot can communicate telepathically. I've been on numerous podcasts with people from British Columbia and Toronto, and some of these folks claim that they are students of Bigfoot, that Bigfoot are their teachers, and that Bigfoot are spiritual creatures who are instructing them. I've heard this from numerous individuals, and again, this is another realm. It's not just not the realm of witnesses seeing something, but the realm of being instructed by being mentored by these cryptids. So I don't know what to make of that. I mean, I one of these guys from British Columbia claims that with my interest in Bigfoot, that possibly Bigfoot is working through me, trying to channel energies through me. And, you know, this is why I'm researching Bigfoot and having such a fascination for it. So this was this guy's explanation for that. I don't know. But the thing that I keep on going back to, and I have a chapter in The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot about the Patterson-Gimlin film. And one thing that's interesting, I know, Simon, you being in the UK, but there was a British primatologist, John Napier, and he was working at the Smithsonian Institute, and they came across, they were offered a copy of this 58-second film of the Paddy, the Sasquatch. And so his people took a look at it. Now, there were a number of people there. There were some Russian scientists and that, but John Napier believed that this film was a hoax. He believed that it was a fake, and that what they did was they put together it was a composite of an ape with strong upper body muscularity, but the bottom of a human, a hominid that was bipedal. And he said that because of that, he didn't believe that this Patterson-Gimlin film was accurate. This was in 1972. In 1974, and again, there were more Brits. They were in Ethiopia, and they discovered Lucy, and that was Australopithecus. And Lucy is the earliest known hominid that we found so far. And they named this hominid Lucy for the Beatles, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. But after John Napier saw this about Lucy, he changed his opinion about the Patterson-Gimlin film and said it has to be correct because Lucy, the Australopithecus, had upper body strength like an ape and had the lower body like a hominid. It was bipedal, it walked on two things. So here's an example of science coming full circle. And you know, and we need to follow the science and respect the science and, you know, hope that, you know, scientists and paleontologists continue to do their due diligence and do their research and, help us with our theories. But John Napier is one of he's another rock star in the industry. I mean, he did a lot, bring a lot to the table. And again, I think that with my research, I mean, you need to go into the past and look at some of the discoveries, some of the people that have helped us make more sense of, our world of cryptozoology and ufology.
So can we talk about Albert Ostman? That was a really weird case.
Yeah, and here's another connection with between Bigfoot and UFOs. You know, thank you for bringing these up. I was almost forgot about that. Albert Ostman was a Swedish Canadian camper outdoorsman, and in 1924, at his camp there in I believe British Columbia, somebody was stealing his food, was messing around with his camp. It was disrupting it. And so what Albert Ostman did was he hid in a sleeping bag and he had a rifle there. And what he was going to do is he was going to wait until this bad guy, this culprit, showed itself, and he was going to take out his rifle and shoot him. And that was the law of the land. That's what you did back then in 1924. Well, what happened was something picked him up and carried him for what he thought was miles and miles and dumped him. And here it was a family of Sasquatch. There was like, it looked like a father, a mother and father, and maybe a little son and daughter. So Ostman said that they treated him with kindness. I mean, they were very altruistic. They fed him sweet grass, and they seemed to just be curious about him, especially the female Sasquatch. So he felt okay with this, but at some point he felt that they were going to utilize him for procreation, and he got a little bit weirded out. He started to get frightened, so he made a plan for escape. And what he did was he was going to go and entice the male Bigfoot to try some of the chewing tobacco. So he did that, and the male, the father Sasquatch, got sick. And that's when Albert Ostman made his break. He took off and was able to escape over the miles. Now, here's the thing. 1924, he kept that secret for years. And then after 1924, there started to become reports of Sasquatch in British Columbia and, you know, in that area. And what he did was he talked to John Green, who was a British Columbia journalist. And John Green was the first one to take Ostman's narrative. And he believed he was telling the truth, because this was back in 1924, before we had computers and microfiche and all the other stuff that you could go and track down Sasquatch and find out what it looked like, what it sounded like, what it smelled like. But Ostman, not having access to any of that information, came up with a narrative that holds true to today. Sasquatch was a family unit. There was the only irregular thing was there was no smell. And we believe that that horrible fetid smell of Sasquatch is a warning to others, or maybe even with the perfume smell, a good sign. But with these Sasquatch, he did not report any kind of a smell, but he talked about how they acted, and you know, he described them as a family unit, when many people who described seeing a Bigfoot only talk about solitary creatures. But here's the thing. That was in 1924. In 63, Betty and Barney Hill were coming back from a vacation, and they were traveling through the White Mountains in New Hampshire, in New England. And they claimed that they were abducted by a UFO and that there was missing time. And so what Betty and Barney Smith did, they went to a psychiatrist in Boston who did regressive hypnosis. And they believe that what happened was that they were abducted by a flying saucer and probed and used for experimentation. So the 1924 Albert Ostman abduction and the 1963 UFO abduction has parallel, again, within the Bigfoot world and the UFO worlds, 1924 and 1963. So you take those red letter dates. You also take the date of 1958, where the word Bigfoot arrived in our lexicon. That was from the article in the Humboldt Times, 1958. And then take a look at 1947, where Kenneth Arnold's 9 flying discs that he saw from Mount Rainier became part of our vocabulary. So 1947 for UFOs and 1958 for Bigfoot. And then again, as I had mentioned, the 1967 Patterson-Gimlin film and the 2004 United States Navy Tic Tac film that was off the coast of San Diego. So you have three events, three different dates that parallel significant events in the world of cryptozoology and the world of ufology. So I look at these things and I track them and I write about them only because I think they are of interest and that they have significance.
And the thing about the Ostman case is that he talked about them like they were family and that they gave him some food. And it sounds like they're a lot more intelligent than, say, your average bear.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were kind. They took care of him, and they fed him. They were curious. But at some point, and he wasn't quite sure why, but he just got it in his head that they might try to procreate with him. And that sort of got his attention, and he had to make a plan for escape. So even though he had the rifle, he didn't want to shoot them. But his account from 1924 is interesting because, again, like I said, this is before anybody was really talking about Sasquatch and writing about it. So his narrative was new. It was unique. And so that was, pretty special to have his thing. And then to compare it with what's happening today, what we're seeing today. So Ostman is one for the history books and, pretty fascinating individual. In The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot, I call out the hoaxers. And I know on a lot of the podcasts that I've done, some of the podcasters have, sort of focused on this a lot. But I don't know. I just claim that there's a lot of people out there that are disingenuous and they're looking for their 50 minutes of fame. And, they do bad things for the cryptozoology and ufology community. And I especially call out people like in my book, I talk about Charles Dawson. He was a British guy. He was a lawyer and amateur fossil collector, but he was involved in the Piltdown Man. And that's an infamous story of how a deceptor, a hoaxer, was able to get the attention of the scientific and political world for at least 40 years before we realized it was a hoax and we realized we were wasting our time. And Dawson claimed that he had found, first of all, in Germany, they had the Heidelberg Man, which was one of the oldest fossils that we had found, the closest relative to man. It was the Heidelberg Man. And when Dawson came out with his Piltdown Man, this sort of gave the British, their claim to fame. This was something that gave them a lot of nationalistic glory. But what it was is it turned out that Dawson took an old human skull, and he took an orangutan jaw. And he had that jaw, he had the teeth shaped like human teeth. And then he peppered those bones with iron oxide to make them look old. He peppered the whole Piltdown Man scene with iron oxide. So he set this up to make it look like it was ancient and authentic, which it wasn't. So finally, after all these years, he was called out and for deceiving the public and especially the scientific community. They're pretty sure that Charles Dawson was the main culprit here, but there may have been other people involved. But anyway, the Piltdown Man was infamous in the annals of cryptozoology and, the lengths that hoaxers would go to get their claim to fame, their notoriety. And again, I claim that these are people that have sold their souls to the devil for their 15 minutes of fame.
When you started investigating Bigfoot, did you find that it was a lot more complicated than you thought it would be?
Well, you're right, because if you could go to the science, you could go find all the scientific data and explain it. And that would be easy. But, you know, there's a lot of detours. You know, the Piltdown Man was one thing. The Minnesota Iceman was another one. That was one that deceived Ivan T. Sanderson and Bernard Helvemans. And these are the fathers of cryptozoology. So the Minnesota Iceman, which was another hoax, sort of made them look foolish, you know, and the realm of cryptozoology look foolish. But it's hard to come up with the truth because we can't find the scientific data. You have hoaxers out there. And what we are left with, we're relegated to theories. And in my case, I take a look at that interdimensional theory, which I believe is probably the most genuine, the one that offers the most explanation for what's going on there. But then even with people that I talk to, I know people that claim to have seen Bigfoot. I know one guy in Western Pennsylvania that claimed that he saw Bigfoot at 15 feet, and he now has PTSD. I know people that claim to have seen Bigfoot, and it was a spiritual awakening, that it was a life, it was a transformative thing for them. Back home, there's the one individual, and a friend of mine, Craig Long, he is a district magistrate. He used to work as law enforcement, and he got a phone call at 11 o'clock at night. This gentleman was letting his dog out for the night and spotted a 12-foot cryptid. And he wasn't afraid. And he told my friend Craig Long he wasn't afraid because the creature had kind eyes. He had kind eyes. So there's all kinds of witnesses. There's all kinds of reactions. And as I say, probably the most dramatic are the ones, these guys that I talked to from Canada and British Columbia, who claim that they communicate with Sasquatch, and Sasquatch is their mentor, their teacher, and teaches them things. So take your pick. I mean, it's hard to hammer down, what this thing is, what it represents, because everybody that sees it seems to have a different approach, a different ideology. And again, I try to approach this as an academic, as a scientist, and to make sense of it that way.
Lastly, I wanted to ask, do you have plans for another book?
Yeah, I do. It's my next book is called Paranormal Apocalypse. Is This How It Ends? And what I do is I take a look at the element of fear. And I contend that religious groups and political groups and doomsday people use fear to control us. They want to get us frightened, and they want to go and control us. And I talk about this, and I talk about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. But it's going to be a wonderful book. It's going to come out this year on Hangar One. And you could certainly, your listeners can certainly take a look at Hangar One Publications, or if they're interested in checking out my website, if I may, I'm at www.maximfuric.com, and that's MAXIMFUREK.com. And of course, the Lost Tribes of Bigfoot and Coal Region Hoodoo and Flying Saucer Esoteric are all on Amazon, as well as some of the other outlets. So I would hope that if any of your readers were to get any of my books, that they would not only read it, but also, and again, I'm really would appreciate this, ask them to put on a review on Amazon. That is probably the best thing that could happen to us, a struggling author. So a review on Amazon is really a wonderful thing for us.
Great. Well, thanks again for coming back to the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Simon. This was excellent. I hope I wasn't too wordy, and but I love talking about these themes. And I mean, I'm just so fascinated by the paranormal and cryptozoology. Just it means a lot to me. It speaks to me.
Great. Thanks again. And that was an interview with Maxime Thurick about his book, The Lost Tribes of Bigfoot. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.